We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future, on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is November 15, 2015, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Very exciting show for you here tonight. It is Sasquatch night here on the program. Three big guests coming up later on in the program, but first, the news. Pope Francis today deplored the terrorist attacks in Paris, which he described as an inconceivable barbarity and an unspeakable affront to human dignity that leaves us shocked and must be condemned. The New York Times reports at least 129 people died and another 99 were injured in Paris on Friday night after 8 terrorists, including one as young as 15, attacked a stadium, restaurants, and a packed concert hall, armed with AK-47s, grenades, and wearing suicide vests. More than 350 were injured, 99 of which are in critical condition, and 30 of the dead have not yet been identified. On a lighter note, a Google self-driving car has been pulled over by police in Mountain View, California for driving too slowly, the BBC reports. No action was taken, but it does raise questions about whether the cars in their current form are too cautious. An accident report recently filed by the California Department of Motor Vehicles described a Google automated car as, quote, overcautious. The car was traveling at 24 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone. Google's response said, quote, we've capped the speed of our prototype vehicles at 25 miles per hour for safety reasons. We want them to feel friendly and approachable, rather than zooming scarily through neighborhood streets. But Google added, in 1.2 million miles of autonomous driving tests, quote, we're proud to say we've never been ticketed. Statistics suggest that 90% of all car accidents are caused by human error, and most experts acknowledge that self-driving cars will drastically reduce the number of road traffic accidents. In a report on, fittingly, unexplained-mysteries.com, inventor and robotics enthusiast Simone Gertz is said to have built a device to help her wake up in the morning. The madcap invention, which she calls the wake-up machine, of all things, combines a conventional alarm clock with a rubber hand, which swings around and repeatedly slaps the hapless sleeper in the face. The 25-year-old, who lives on a houseboat in Sweden, tested the invention out on herself several times, and while it certainly works, it isn't exactly the gentlest way to get someone out of bed. A video of the device is available on YouTube.com. In a few moments, we will be joined by Dr. Matthew A. Johnson of Team Squatchin' USA. On July 1st, 2000, Dr. J had a Class A Bigfoot encounter with his family while hiking on a mountain above the Oregon Caves National Monument Park. After his life-changing sighting, he went public and described one of the most intense encounters ever. At present, Dr. J has two habituation areas, the Southern Oregon Habituation Area, SOA, which was established in 2007, and the Washington Habituation Area, WAHA, which was established in 2011. Dr. Johnson will be our guest on the program tonight. But first, this weekend is the third annual Sasquatch Summit, which kicks off this Friday, November 20th, at the Quinault Beach Resort and Casino in Ocean Shores, Washington. I'll be there, as will our first two guests this evening. David Ellis of the Olympic Project will be presenting at the conference and as a quick teaser for us tonight, as well as Johnny Manson. I want to welcome to the show both Johnny and David Ellis of the Olympic Project. And Johnny, we'll start with you. Tell us about this year's summit.
Well, the summit is a weekend of Bigfoot research, and it's Friday night and Saturday at the Quinault Beach Resort and Casino in Ocean Shores. This is our third year. And we have, like, the top-notch Bigfoot researchers from around the world present their research. And then we have, Sasquatch-related vendors that, you know, sell, you know, Bigfoot T-shirts and casts and trinkets and just fun things for those enthusiasts. And then if witnesses want to come forward and share their experience with everybody, they're more than welcome to. Or if they, you know, because some people are real private about their experiences, they get a chance to talk maybe one-on-one with a researcher that might, give them, like, the good vibe, like, hey, I think I want to share what I saw with David Ellis, because he's a real nice guy, he's real approachable, and I feel comfortable. And it's just a really great weekend for Bigfoot enthusiasts.
Tell everybody a little bit about how this whole thing got started. You mentioned it's the third year, and if you go to the website, which is SasquatchSummit.com, you can see a couple of pictures from years past, and there's a lot of people there. How has this thing grown?
It's just kind of snowballed into this big, wonderful thing for our area, and then just for the whole cause of research, but I work in radio, and I wanted to do something in our area, and I've always been a Bigfoot enthusiast myself since a very early age, and I just got to thinking, how come we don't have a Bigfoot conference here in Grays Harbor, where we have, you know, some of the majority of sightings, and I just thought we needed to have one here. So it was kind of funny because I was with my sales manager, and we were driving out to the Quinault Beach Resort and Casino just to, you know, meet with management and just, you know, hey, how you doing and stuff, because we have a relationship, a business relationship anyway. And I told my manager, I'm like, hey, you know, I've been having this idea. I got this thing growing in my head that I want to try to do. So we get there, we have lunch, and then he just goes, oh, hey, and Johnny has a proposal for you. And I'm like, what? You know, I was not prepared to, you know, to present anything to anybody. It was just a thought. And so I kind of just stumbled through it, saying, hey, I want to do a conference, and it would be like this. And they were like, okay, let's do it. How can we help? So, and that was 2013. That was for the 2013 conference, which was the inaugural, and we had, I don't know, probably a little over 300. And we were thinking, it's either going to bomb or it's going to blow up. And so far it's blown up, and we're really appreciative of that. We have a lot of good help, too.
You got a lot of great guests that are going to be presenting at the Sasquatch Summit, which is coming up this weekend. One of them is on the line, David Ellis of the Olympic Project. And I know that David's got some very interesting things he's working on. He's got a presentation. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Ryan.
Do we get a teaser for this weekend?
Yeah. sent you a short little clip that I think that you might enjoy.
We've got this clip here. I'm going to play it here on the air, and then we'll let you talk about it. And you've sent me a bunch of clips. We're going to play one today as a teaser. And obviously, if you want to hear the whole presentation, Sasquatch Summit coming up this weekend, SasquatchSummit.com. Here is the audio clip. Here we go. That's a very unnerving scream right there, and we've had you on the show before. We've talked a lot of different clips. Tell us the story behind that one.
Well, there was a group of us attending a Bigfoot conference, believe it or not, in honor of Bob Gimlin a few years back, and a group of us were camped in a location near Natchez, Washington, up in the mountains, in an area that a group of us have been going to. And we were on a road walk. That's where a group of people get together and take off and go hiking down logging roads in hopes of maybe having some interaction. And we actually struck gold that night. Was with, Stan Courtney. Some people in the Bigfoot community recognize him as one of the premier field recordists. And he and a group of people went one direction, and myself and a group of other people went another direction. And we were in radio communication, and Stan did a vocalization to elicit, you know, in hopes of eliciting a response. And within about 15 seconds, we got a response. We could not hear Stan's actual vocalization. He was on the backside of another ridge, but whatever it was could hear his vocalization, I believe, and responded. And what I got was the response. Actually, what you played was four vocalizations that were looped twice. So there's what sounds like eight vocals is actually four vocalizations that we captured that night.
And your website, obviously, if you want to head up there, is olympicproject.com. And I know you're speaking, it's Saturday from 1 to 2:30, the Olympic Project, multiple presentations here, it says, at the Great Hall. And what are some of the things we can look forward to that day?
Well, I will personally be going over about 30 to 31 different recordings that I have from the field that I think may be of interest to people. Also presenting in our group will be Cindy Dosen and Tom Baker. Cindy is really good at hair collection and hair identification. She has a large electron microscope and is developing quite a library of known and unknown hair samples. And so she will be talking about that. And then Tom will be talking about observable patterns that we think that people might be interested in knowing. We're searching for predictability. That is the hope and the bottom line, so that we can enhance our chances of being in the right place at the right time, which is what it takes to have an encounter. Two things. It takes a person and a Bigfoot, you know. So if we can enhance our chances of an intersection, that's what we're hoping to do.
And Johnny, there's a lot of other big speakers as well. Ron Moorhead is going to be there. He was just on Art Bell's show. Cliff Brackman of Animal Planet's Finding Bigfoot is going to be there. Who else can we look forward to?
I got a Cliff has actually had to reschedule for next year due to filming issues. They I guess they decided to start filming another season of Finding Bigfoot, and they started mid-November. So he had to back out, and he had said that if he, and this happened the first year also, that if he's, you know, off the plane and is up to it, if he's around, he'll come by, but he can't make any kind of guarantees, but he has signed up for next year. So cool. I just wanted to make that clear.
All right. Well, who else do we have in terms of speakers for the weekend?
Well, Scott Nelson, the cryptolinguist who does a lot of work alongside with Ron Moorhead, he's going to be there. We have Tom Powell. He's returning. Tom Cantrell. We have Scott Taylor of the BFRO. Paul Graves. Let's see. Todd and Diane Neese will be presenting as well. I know I'm going to forget somebody. Bob Gimlin's going to be there, and we kind of give Bob free rein. If he wants to come up, grab the mic, he's more than welcome to. If he wants to sit in the corner by himself, he's more than welcome to. He kind of gets to do whatever he wants to do. And Toby Johnson's going to be there. We're going to have music kind of in between things that happen on Friday. And then if time permits, Saturday, but we run a pretty tight schedule. So there's, you know, raffles going on. And we try to represent kind of a broad spectrum of research and research techniques and philosophies and things. To give a little bit of everything for everybody and just kind of let them make up their own minds.
I believe that we also have Guy Edwards and Dr. John Bindernagel.
Yep, very good. Thanks, David.
Yeah.
David's on top of things here.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And once again, it's olympicproject.com. And Johnny, I want to give you a chance before we go to direct everybody to where they can go on the website to register, sign up, and any other details you want to give out about the weekend.
Thank you. They can go to SasquatchSummit.com and buy tickets online. We will have tickets available if, you know, at the door. But online kind of guarantees you, because we give you some kind of swag with your admission, which, you know, there's a field guide and, you know, Bigfoot keychain and pass and lanyard and some really fun stuff. And it's only $30 to come, and that covers both days. And then Sunday, for those that are still in the area and that want to participate, the Olympic Project hosts a CAST class on, the fundamentals of pouring casts and identifying, and David Ellis usually participates in that, and he probably knows, and I'm not buttering him up, but he's probably the most thorough caster I've ever encountered in my life. He covers everything, and that alone is worth more than $30 to me. But that's on Sunday. It's kind of an impromptu thing, but it's just going to be music, food, Bigfoot, and it's just going to be a whole weekend of fun.
SasquatchSummit.com, $30 for the two-day pass to the entire summit, and all of the information, once again, is up at SasquatchSummit.com. Johnny and David, thank you so much, and I will see you this weekend. We will be right back with Dr. Matthew A. Johnson of Team Squatchin' USA to talk Bigfoot habituation here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Dr. Matthew A. Johnson. Dr. J is here on the show today. We're going to be talking Bigfoot, SOA, Team Squatchin' USA. The list goes on and on. Dr. J, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, Brian. Thanks for having me on your show.
You got a lot of stuff online. If you go to Team Squatchin' USA, you can check out all sorts of media. You've got a SoundCloud page with all sorts of different audio clips. We'll be playing a few of those here on the show today. You've got a lot of YouTube videos. You've been doing this a long time. Decade. Well over a decade.
15 years.
15 years. Now, let's start here at the very beginning, then we'll kind of get into everything.
Okay.
To the best of my knowledge, this all began for you when you and your family were out hiking and you had an experience. Is that correct?
Correct. July 1st, 2000.
Tell everybody what happened that day.
Well, in a nutshell, we had just moved down from Alaska about 6 months earlier. And keep in mind, I was a 20-year resident of Alaska with all kinds of outdoor experience, camping, hiking, fishing, a little bit of hunting. Very familiar with wildlife, not afraid to be in the outdoors, chased by a grizzly bear on one occasion. I knew what bear are. I knew what bear looked like. So we had all that underneath our belt, including our kids being hikers. So my wife at that time and I took our children to the Oregon Caves for a tour. Then we came out of the caves and, you know, they're pretty cold inside. And so we sat down at a picnic bench and ate some lunch. Then we decided to go for a hike up on the mountain above the caves. It was a warm day outside the cave. And it's a 3.5-mile loop, which was no big deal for us and our young kids at that time. So we started the hike up the right side of the trail. We got about a mile up the mountain. We walked through a patch of a real strong smell, as strong as a skunk, but it wasn't a skunk. And we kind of looked at each other, but we kept on going because we knew it wasn't anything we needed to be worried about. And we rounded a corner, a switchback, and kept going up the mountain. And then we started being paralleled by some kind of animal that was making a deep bass guttural woof, woof, woof noise. And that's not even close to resembling what it really sounded like. And when we were walking, it'd make the noise. When we stopped, it stopped. When we walked, it made the noise. When we stopped, it stopped. And I looked at everybody and said, are you hearing that? And they're all nodding their heads, yes. But again, we weren't afraid. We were curious because we knew we weren't in Alaska, so we didn't have to worry about grizzly bear. And there was nothing else we really, really needed to worry about up there in Oregon. So we kept going on with our hike. Eventually, the kids at that time, ages 9, 7, and 5, wanted to stop, take a little break, and began playing with the bug on the path with a stick, and Mother Nature was knocking on my door. So I decided to hike off the trail up through some brush and trees and did my thing. And while I was pulling my pants back up, I was skating down the mountainside, and that's when I saw Bigfoot walk off the pages of myth and legend into reality and got my family out of there and made a report to the headquarters after we got off the mountain, and then the rest is history.
Now, is it true that you wanted to follow this thing and your kids were freaking out and essentially suggested to you, let's get out of here?
No. Not in that event, no.
Oh, this was a different event.
That's a different event. No, when I saw it, I ran down through the brush and trees, and I moved my family along without telling them what I just saw. We hiked a couple hundred yards more on the trail. Then I sat the kids down, gave them some water, pulled my wife aside, said, you're not going to believe what I saw. And she said, what? And I said, Bigfoot. And she said, I believe you. And then we came up with a game plan to get ourselves off that mountain. Never told the kids about that. What you're referring to is about 5 years ago when I was told by a friend that, 9 years ago when I was told by a friend that he found some tracks on the mountainside by a pond, wanted me to come out and check out the tracks.
I'm That's like, right.
No, I'm not going to do that. And he said, no, really, come on out. And I said, I don't ambulance chase. I don't go from one reported sighting to another. He said, you got to see these tracks. And I said, okay, I'll come out. So I went out with my kids and found the tracks by the pond, and they were 22-inch tracks, which made my size 16 feet look really small. And I started casting this track, and over the knoll, all three of us, myself and two of my kids, heard this squatch growl, just, and my eyes lit up, and I, you know, started walking toward the knoll, and my kids are going, Dad, what are you doing? And I said, there's a squatch on the other side of that knoll, and they're going, we know, get back here. What if he does something to you? Then we're out here alone. So I came back, and a couple days later, I went back up there and followed the tracks up the mountainside, which led to a ridge line. And keep in mind, when I was following the tracks up the mountainside, it wasn't on some nice paved trail. It was through thickets and brush and trees, and it just was a lot of work to get up to that ridge line. And then I eventually established a base camp up there.
Now let's go back.
Known as
SOA, yes.
Southern Oregon, which is now known as the Southern Oregon Habituation Area, otherwise known as SOA, S-O-H-A.
Yes. Now, before we get into that, let's go back to the first sighting there. You looked down and you saw this thing. And how would you describe it? Size, width, weight, etc.?
I would describe it as being about 9 feet tall. Weight, I don't know, could be anywhere between 600 and 900 pounds. It was as tall, actually taller than an NBA player, as buff as an NFL football player. And the reason why I know it was about 9 feet tall is because a couple days later went up there again with my family and a ranger from the park and some other people. And the Squatch that I saw was standing behind an old growth tree, but it was looking over the top of a new growth tree. And I'm almost 7 feet tall, and I can reach 8 feet really easy. Played a lot of basketball, and the new growth tree that it was looking over the top of was 8 feet tall, so it had to have been at least 9 feet tall.
So this is your first ever sighting. You see what you later determined to be a 9-foot Sasquatch, and whether you knew the height or not at the time, you could see that it was very, very big. And your first reaction, obviously, was to get your family out of there. When you went down the hill, did they suspect anything? I mean, I'd presume that you were hurriedly trying to get them out of there. Was there any, I guess, speculation on their part that something must have happened here? Or were you able to, I guess, keep your emotions in check while you calmly got them off the mountain?
Well, I kept my emotions in check, and I calmly pushed them along, although pushing them along was not normal. So they knew something was up, but they couldn't figure out what was up. And, you know, later on after we got off the mountain and we started driving home, you know, the kids picked up on the fact that Daddy had talked with the park ranger for a while, and park rangers asked them some questions and my ex-wife some questions, and they're going, "What's going on?" You know, as we're driving home, and my ex-wife goes, "Oh, nothing. Daddy just saw Bigfoot." So they
have since, so you didn't tell me the time, but they're well aware now.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, in one of the videos that you've posted online, there is an interview with a person who works, I guess, for the park services or whatever the case might be, and they state that we're not allowed to talk about Bigfoot. Now, is this a situation where if we talk about it, we're acknowledging it, and we don't even want to acknowledge it, so we just say that we're not allowed to talk about it? Or do you feel that there are forest rangers that know something about this and have been told not to talk about it?
Well, that female forest ranger that you're referring to in one of our videos said, "We're not allowed to talk about it. You have to talk with Ranger John Roth or Craig Ackerman." And John Roth was the park ranger who investigated the area 2 days after the encounter. He found a large track there, and, you know, several of us were standing around that large track while he was squatted on the ground pointing out the features, and then he looked up at us and he said, "You need to know that the park has a policy that we will not take a public position on the presence of Sasquatch within our park boundaries." And we're all kind of looking at each other going, "What? They have a policy?" Well, you don't have a policy unless a bunch of people sit down in a room and talk about a policy, and you don't sit down in a room, talk about creating a policy unless you have a reason to create the policy.
Well, it's weird because let's just imagine that there's no such thing as a Bigfoot. And the Park Service has never seen anything that they believe could be a Bigfoot. If you believe that, then shouldn't the policy just be that if people ask, we deny? Why would the policy be that we have no position? Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it is weird. And after that, I put together a group of men along with Dr. Bill York, who at that time was a British wildlife biologist. He has passed away 12 years ago. But we went up there, about 15 of us, south of the park boundaries on the mountain, and found a couple different bedding areas. We were visited by three squatches the first night we were there. We established a research area there, and I made the mistake of keeping the park rangers informed of our progress, and they immediately dug up our access road with a backhoe and killed our access. Well, we walked in there anyway and found where they had put a 4-foot pen that you would like put a dog in out in the backyard, and they had a rabbit in there, and they had two video cameras focused on it. So I leaned over the pen. Again, I'm a tall guy, almost 7 feet tall, grabbed the rabbit, freed it, turned toward the video camera, flipped them off, walked away.
So I guess we're to presume that you were looking, and they presumed that maybe there was something there, and that was bait to try to capture it on film? They were running their own investigation.
Yeah, they dug up our road first before they started running their own investigation, because he specifically asked me, what road are you using to get up there? And I was naive enough to tell him, and then it got dug up.
It's just weird to me because, again, if there's nothing to any of this, then your public stance should be just to have your ranger say, I've never seen anything out there, and I don't believe it exists. But
yeah, well, John Roth made it really clear in subsequent interviews for TV programs that he does believe they exist. As a matter of fact, he wrote a book about Bigfoot and little people, and he definitely is a believer. But I think he and some others commandeered our research area.
Let's talk about a little bit, since you just mentioned it, the little people. So he's written about Bigfoot and little people.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this, because I don't know a lot about it. Is his belief that little people, or what in the past had been referred to as fairies, are also out there in our national forests?
You know, I have no idea what John Roth believes, and to be quite honest, I've never read his book because I had no interest in little people. And when I first heard about that, I thought, doggone it, why did I have to get a ranger like him to verify that he found Bigfoot tracks, et cetera, up on the mountain if he's going to start talking about little people on TV interviews? So that was my feeling. And John Roth's a nice guy, by the way. He's a very good guy. But let's just say 15 years ago, I knew absolutely nothing. And I just didn't like the fact that he was a proponent of little people. And he'd bring it up occasionally when he was interviewed for various TV programs that came out to the park to film myself and my crew out there researching.
And we're talking about elves, or like little hairy people, like little miniature Bigfoot. What was he talking about?
I don't know. I didn't explore it. I've heard since that time from other people what they think little people are, but I don't know what John Roth thinks little people are, because, again, I haven't read his book.
What do other people think these little people are?
Well, what I've heard from other people are about little people is that some of them think they fit the criteria of little elves or little miniature Bigfoot or just tiny human beings. Lots of different takes on it. I can't really comment on it myself because I've never seen a little person out there in the woods.
So you have, and we'll talk about this more obviously, seen many Sasquatch, but never a little person, never an elf, anything like that?
No. Saw some guardians for a portal, but we'll talk about that later, but
yes.
I wouldn't classify them as little people.
Now, on a somewhat related but different topic, since you brought it up, obviously, somebody who has been doing a lot of media rounds of late is David Politis, missing 411. And while he does not ever try to alert us as to what his conclusions are, many people who listen to his interviews believe that what he's trying to say is that Bigfoot is out there eating people in national forests. And again, he won't come right out and say it, but that is the conclusion that people have come to. And
Right. Whatever
his beliefs are, you are of the belief that Bigfoot is not out there eating people. Is that right?
Correct. And David Pilates tried to, he did interview me and tried to include my story in his book about 14 years ago. And he interviewed me. He sent me a transcript. I tried to correct it. It was about 75% accurate, 25% inaccurate, because he was trying to hype up the story to make it more traumatic and life-threatening. So I sent it back. He corrected maybe 2, 3%. I said, that's not good enough. Correct this stuff. He corrected maybe 2, 3% more. And I'm like, you know what? I got a private practice. I got a family. I'm teaching a Sunday school class. I'm coaching a basketball team. I don't have time. And I'm seeing clients in my private practice. I don't have time to play this ping pong back and forth. So I'm not going to, you know, sign your affidavit. You don't get to use my story if you're going to try to make it into something that it's not. Well, that led me to believe if he tried to hype up my story for his book, how many other stories did he do that to put them in his book? And other people went along with it because, yeah, I get to get my story in David Pilates' book. And I'm like, I don't roll that way, but maybe some other people do. And then he and I got into a PM pissing match a couple years later. And, actually a couple years ago. And, you know, he's like, you know, it's Bigfoot. You need to say it's Bigfoot. And I'm like, David, you're the guy who's writing the books, but you never say it in your books and you never say it in any of your media interviews. If you think it's Bigfoot, then you need to come out and say it in your books or in your media interviews. I'm not going to say it for you. And besides, I don't think it is Bigfoot. So, you know, it causes me to question the veracity of his book.
Now, do you have any sort of theory? Because there are many, many people who disappear in the national forests. And if you don't believe that it is Bigfoot, do you have any theory? Are these all just natural disappearances, cougars, whatever?
Well, there's lots of wildlife out there. There's, you know, lots of ways to just simply get lost. People can get injured. There's lots of different ways that people can disappear out there. And statistically speaking, it's probably wildlife and getting lost and just unfortunate injuries where people can't crawl out and, you know, they die. They run out of water and food and they die and their bodies get consumed and you can't find them and they're gone.
As you noted, SOHA is the Southern Oregon Habituation Area, S-O-H-A, and yep. You've been there for a while. And let's talk about...
Years.
Yes, 9 years. Let's talk about habituation, because as you have noted in other interviews, you've seen guys running around in the woods, knocking on trees, putting up trail cams, doing all of this craziness, and you believe that this is not the right way to try to capture proof of Bigfoot.
Correct. I refer to them as old schoolers who are engaged in the aggressive paparazzi money shot approach. And to be fair to those guys, I was them for the first 10 years. I've been out in the field for 15 years. So the first 10 years of my 15 years, I was them. I did that. I used high-tech equipment. I blasted out calls. I whacked on trees. I did everything I shouldn't have been doing, just like they're still doing. The problem with that approach is, you know, they have Peter Byrne and a bunch of other guys who... They, you know, Rene DeHinden, who they just worship like the four horsemen. And it's like, so Peter Byrne was out there for 40 years doing this, and he has no proof, no evidence, never saw a Squatch, and you think he's one of the four horsemen. And then they go out and keep doing what they're doing, and the only thing that Peter Byrne has managed to accomplish over 40 years is showing us how not to do it. And that's what I learned during my first 10 years, how not to do it. So then 5 years ago, I switched over to the habituation research method. I started doing what all the crazy kooks were talking about, who, by the way, I used to rip apart in the email listserv groups before Facebook existed. And whenever anyone talked habituation and all the other stuff that comes along with it, I would splice them and slice them, and I was not kind. And then I switched over 5 years ago, and my level of interactions and visuals have increased exponentially and have been affirmed by multiple witnesses who've come with me to SOA over the last 5 years of my habituation mode, and we're talking like 30 people. So there's no way. I mean, if it was me, you'd say, Matt, you're psycho, you're a liar, but when it's me plus 30 people, you don't get to say that.
Obviously, the location of SOA is not public because it's your area. What can you tell us about it in terms of rough area where it's located, how much area it consists of, etc.?
Well, first of all, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
That's right. In a national forest, I'm sure.
That's right, where they can't find your body, and then we'll blame the Bigfoot. Let's see. It's up on a mountaintop. It's in the Siskiyou Mountains in southern Oregon, where there are endless mountains from about 100 miles north of the Oregon-California border to about 200 miles south of the border. So we're talking endless number of mountaintops, and that's about as specific regarding the location I'm going to get. But we're at the end of a dead-end logging road, and it slopes down on both sides, and it's very beautiful up there, very quiet. It's far away from civilization, and it's an awesome place.
I've been there for 9 years now, and for those listening to this right now that are hearing habituation, 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 explain what that means to everybody.
First of all, you referenced 9 years, and I'd like to point out to your listeners that I already noted that my first 10 years and my 15 years were the old school approach. So that means the first 4 years of being in SOA, I was still utilizing the old school aggressive paparazzi money shot approach, and I was still getting pretty much nowhere up in SOA. So I made my switch over to the habituation research method 5 years ago after putting in 4 years of the old school approach in the same area. And when I switched over 5 years ago, that's when everything took off. Now, how do I describe the habituation research method? Leave the high-tech equipment at home. Change the way you view the Bigfoot forest people species. They're not descendants of Gigantopithecus. They're not dumb giant mountain apes. The North American Indians have been right all along. They've interacted with them for thousands of years, and all over North America, they have described them as people, forest people, having a tribe, having a language, having special abilities. So instead of me showing up to your home and pounding on your door, maybe kicking it in, hanging game trail cams in on the walls, and going directly to your bedroom and digging through your bed trying to find hair samples and yelling and blasting out calls at you and whacking on the walls with sticks, I show up to your home, I pleasantly knock on the door, you let me in, I bring some food, we sit down, we chill, we socialize, and my guess is you'd prefer that approach as opposed to the aggressive, disrespectful approach. And that's what the habituation research method is all about, treating them as if they're forest people, showing up with gifts, chilling out, using only passive technology, and such as a bionic ear, parabolic microphone dish anchored in the base camp. And, you know, just chill. And eventually, over time, they come to us. And I might add, now, every time we show up, every night, they come to the perimeter of our base camp. Every night.
Now, this will tie into another question, but probably seems like a simple question, but where do they live?
Well, that's going to depend upon which part of the country you're talking about, because the geography varies, and so therefore, you know, where they live varies. But we're talking specifically my SOA family. I believe there's a cave on the side of the mountain, and I believe they hang out there. I've been up there 9 years. They're there year-round. Other people postulate around the country that they migrate. Well, maybe in their part of the country they do migrate. I don't know. I'm not there. They are. But I can assure you that in the Southern Oregon habituation area, SOA, they're there year-round. They don't migrate.
The reason I ask where they live is You mentioned that you were there for several years doing the old school techniques, and then you switched to habituation. And that would mean that the old school techniques don't work in terms of trying to gather good evidence, but it also doesn't run them off. They just aren't around when you're around. It's not like they relocate when somebody comes into the area and starts going crazy.
No, they're very evasive. They're as smart out there in the woods as we are in the cities. They know how to avoid you. They know how to hide and watch you, you know, tree peekers and the hide-and-seek champions of the forest. They, you know, some people get concerned about, well, what if somebody finds SOA? You know, I don't want that to happen, but if it did happen, the SOA squatches can take care of themselves. And it's not like those people are going to show up and be able to habituate with the squatch family, because the squatch family doesn't know them. And they're smart enough to know that difference. They know who I am. And they know they don't know who the other people would be if they actually got lucky and found SOA, and they won't interact with them. They would avoid them.
Now, the obvious question to you, Dr. J, is what is your goal, in the sense that are you happy just personally knowing they exist, bringing up people to show that they exist? And you can live out your days just hanging out with them, and that's the end of that. Or is your ultimate goal to be the person who discovers, so to speak, reveals to the world that this is a real thing?
Yes.
The latter.
No, yes.
Both.
Yes.
That's okay.
Both.
Both.
Yep.
Okay, so now the follow-up question would be, your habituation method requires, as you noted, very little equipment. There's no trail cams, very, very simple equipment, you noted. And obviously, in order to prove the existence to the scientific community, you're going to need ample evidence. So what is the plan in terms of gathering that ample evidence while at the same time doing habituation where you're not bringing out a lot of equipment?
Okay, here is the dilemma that others find themselves in. The only way we're going to prove this is we need a body or we need to capture one. Well, need a body means they either need to find a dead body and bring it in, or they need to kill one and bring it in. That's what need a body means, or capture one, we'll keep it alive, but that's never going to happen. And they only see that, you know, those are the only ways to do it. Well, they're wrong. They're wrong, and here's why they're wrong. If you habituate with them and you develop a relationship with them and they come in and they get to know you, and over time I have predicted that they're going to come in closer and closer and closer. They're going to start coming into camp at night while we're asleep, and eventually they'll start coming in while we're awake, which is happening, I might add. They come in all the time when we're sleeping, and they're starting to come into camp while we're awake. And eventually, once they feel comfortable doing that, they'll come into camp during the daylight, and then eventually, once that gets going really well and everyone's feeling relaxed and comfortable, then, with their permission, and this may not happen for another 10, 20 years, I'll be able to videotape collecting hair samples and swabbing their cheeks, which will remove any doubt of the chain of custody of the DNA, and voila, you have proof, documented proof of how the DNA was collected and who it was collected from without having to find a dead body, kill one, or capture one.
So at this point, it is a waiting game.
Patience, persistence, discipline, commitment, long term.
You mentioned 10 to 20 years, and you also noted that they're coming out more often when you're around. I mean, do you have anything besides a general time frame? I mean, how has this escalated in the last, say, 5 years?
Well, the first 4 years up and so I was still doing the old school method, and then I switched over to habituation. I could tell, you know, I was putting food out there, and it took 5 years. They never took my food, even with the 1 year of transition to the habituation. I could tell they were coming in closer. They're starting to get a little curious. They could tell that I was switching my approach. And then starting year six up there, or 4 years ago, they started taking my food for the first time, which was absolutely incredible. And then they were leaving fingerprints on the gifting bowls. And when I prepare the gifting bowls, I put on surgical gloves. I wash them out. I have witnesses watch me do this and put the food in, deliver the bowls while wearing surgical gloves, retrieve the bowls the next morning while wearing surgical gloves. My guests are not permitted to touch the bowls, and we find handprints and fingerprints on the bowls while the food is selectively removed from the bowls, quite often less than what's left behind, which would never happen with a little critter or another animal. And so bottom line is, things started changing 4 years ago, and then they've really taken off over the last 2 years, up to the point of where I did a solo 2 months ago, and the male squatch, the adolescent male squatch, about 7.5 feet tall, walked into camp with his younger juvenile sister and stood there for about 90 seconds and then turned around and walked out. And then about an hour later, the younger juvenile sister crawled over the berm and sat down with her back against the berm between a couple, you know, bushes. And while I was working the perimeter with my cell phone playing YouTube music videos with an external Bose speaker, and they love the music, and she was sitting right there. So when I'm working the perimeter, I'm like 5 feet away from her, and she's just watching. She's just listening. So, and then the last trip I went just a couple weeks ago, I had a lady up there with me, and we were at the 12 o'clock position on the perimeter. And 6 feet away to the left at the 11 o'clock position, we had an 8-foot squatch. And about 6 feet away on the right at about the 1 o'clock position, we had about a 9-foot squatch. And we were just standing there looking at them. They were looking at us, and she kind of bowed her head toward the ground because she was overwhelmed and wanted to show submission. And so, you know, that kind of stuff is starting to happen.
You really have to show submission when it's 9 feet tall?
That's what she felt like doing. You need to keep in mind that she's in her early 50s, and last time she went camping was when she was 11.
Yeah.
So she's a city girl, and so, you know, she was a real trooper going out there like she did, and, you know, she was terrified on the inside, but she handled herself well.
What are the fingerprints like? Are they like ours?
Well, they're like ours in the sense that they look like fingers and they have dermal ridges, but they're going in different directions than what humans do. My fiance works for a large law enforcement agency in the state of Washington, and so she had their fingerprint expert look at the handprints and the fingerprints, and he said they're not human. And he also has, for a hobby, examined, you know, palm prints and fingerprints from primates at the zoo in Seattle. So he's very familiar with that as well. And he said what he was looking at off our bowls and off the windows of the vehicles was not human and not related to anything that he has seen in the zoo in Seattle, Washington.
Did you tell him what these prints were? Did you just say, what do you think these prints are?
Afterwards. After he said afterwards, after he examined them and said they weren't human or like anything he's seen in the zoo. Then he asked what they were, and then my fiance told him, and then he was like a kid in a candy shop because he and his family had an experience when he was a kid and they were out camping.
So
and she didn't find that out from him until after he examined them and then they had a talk.
Sure. Now, obviously when people theorize about Sasquatch, there are people who think, well, you know, maybe it's a relic Gigantopithecus. Maybe it's something that is more evolved than an ape, but not as evolved as a human. All sorts of different theories. This person said, well, they're not human. They're not ape. Did he later feel, well, it appears to be something in between? Or was he sort of like, I've never seen anything like this. This doesn't even seem like something from this world.
All he said was they're not human and they're not like anything he saw at the zoo in Seattle. He didn't go beyond that saying anything in this world or something evolving. He didn't go into that kind of detail. He just confirmed they weren't human and that they weren't from the Seattle Zoo.
How many are we talking about here that you believe are in and around the SOA area?
Okay, the immediate SOA family has Dad, who's about 9 feet tall, who showed himself to me almost 2 years ago for the very first time. Mom is about 8 feet tall. The adolescent male, who I first saw several years ago when he was just about 5 feet tall, is now 7.5 feet tall. The juvenile female, who's now becoming a young adolescent female, is standing about 5.5 feet tall. Then there's a toddler who we have recorded shortly after its birth about 3 years ago, who is standing about 3 feet tall. And then there's a baby that was popped out about a year ago, who we also have recorded. So there's an immediate family has six members. And then occasionally, not often, but occasionally, we get visited by what I would say are other members of the clan. They live in family groups. Family groups belong to a clan. So occasionally, they'll have other clan members visit on the perimeter as well.
Let's give everybody, we'll play some audio clips here in a while, but let's tell everybody some of the experiences over the last few years that you have had in SOA. First off, tell everyone how often you're out there camping, and what are some of the common experiences?
Well, I'm out there at least once a month for a weekend, anywhere from 3, 4, 5 days, sometimes almost a week. Sometimes I'll be there twice a month. Over the last 5 years, I had moved from Southern Oregon up to the Puyallup, Washington area to be with my fiance. So I would still make the trip once a month. So I would drive, close to 1,000 miles round trip every month to continue with the habituation research method. I certainly, by the way, was not driving 1,000 miles a month to perpetuate a hoax. I was driving 1,000 miles round trip a month to continue with my work, with my research. Some of the stuff that I experienced up there, 4 years ago, we recorded our first vocal. My 8-year boy now was about 4 years old then, and we record all night long with parabolic microphone dish, so we will record for, 10 to 14 hours nonstop. And in the morning, he woke up and he had to go to the bathroom. So he unzipped the tent, went out to go to the bathroom, realized he was not strong enough to pick up the 5-gallon water jug to pour water into the portable toilet. So he came back in and whispered, "Daddy, I need you to take care of the water." Well, he knows we're recording, so he's whispering, he's being quiet, very well-behaved young man. And so I get up and I'm like, okay, go out there, I'll be right out. Well, later on, playing back the audio recording, both times my son stepped outside the tent, we had the same word whispered by the adolescent male, "Ego Y8. And I was so thrilled when I caught that. It sounded like a North American Indian dialect with staccato syllables, and that was majorly cool. It's like they have a freaking spoken language. There's no way that these guys are dumb giant mountain apes. There's no way that they're descendants of Gigantopithecus. They have a spoken language. They're a forest people. This is awesome. Well, since that time, I've recorded a plethora of words or language and humming and songs, and it's been absolutely incredible. And you referenced at the beginning my SoundCloud file. All the listeners have to do is go to SoundCloud.com and type in Team Squatching USA. And they can listen to a plethora of audio recordings. And I also have them recorded saying my name, Matt, over 30 times. It's been awesome.
Well, let's play one of them here. There's about a million. As you noted, this is at SoundCloud. You can go to SoundCloud.com and type in Team Squatchin' USA. And it scrolls and scrolls and scrolls and scrolls and scrolls. Do you have any idea how many audio clips you have up there?
A lot. No, a lot. And I freely share my information. Nobody has to pay anything to listen to those audio recordings. And that's one thing I've always done is I freely share my research information no matter what it is. openly, honestly. I don't hide anything.
All right, completely at random, this will be Distant Bigfoot Vocal, an enhanced version. So here we go. You can hear the growl right there on that one. Tell us a little bit about these growls. What is your typical sound that you hear when, I guess, are there growls, howls, what do we got?
Well, the typical sound that I hear from them is spoken language and singing and humming. That's the typical sound I get from them. Occasionally we'll get a grunt. Occasionally we'll get a growl. Occasionally we'll hear them imitating owls or some other animal noises, but the majority of my audio recordings are of spoken language or humming or singing. So what's interesting is when I brought Adam Davies up there, all he was interested in was the grunt, because he's locked into them being descendants of Gigantopithecus for being, you know, an upright mountain ape. And so he's concerned about grunts and growls, and he poo-poos the whole spoken language thing, because if he acknowledges, or anybody else out there acknowledges, that they have spoken language, then they have to give up the theoretical position that they are descendants of Gigantopithecus, and they're forced to start looking at them as being forest people because they have a spoken language, and then that means they have to change their whole approach to how they interact with them, and they've got their heels dug in, and they don't want to do it, so they blow off the spoken language, and they just focus in on grunts and growls.
Why could anyone blow out or blow off anything, in the sense that we really don't know? And why, if you believe that this is an ape or something, can you completely rule out the idea that maybe they have a language?
Because there are two schools out there that I've already referenced. Old school has a theoretical box that they find themselves in, and they're trying to cram a peg into a round hole, and they're trying to make Bigfoot fit into this small, rigid, theoretical box. So if any data comes in that doesn't fit into that small, rigid, theoretical box, they blow off, because they're not open-minded, and they don't want to come outside that box. And again, to be fair to them, I was that way for the first 10 years. Well, once you start pursuing the truth, instead of reinforcing an errant theoretical position, then your mind starts to get blown by all the data that comes in regarding the forest people. And the BFRO, by the way, that exists in that small, rigid theoretical box, if they have any kind of data that comes in with a report that doesn't fit in the box, they will deep six that report.
See, I don't like that. I mean, even earlier this show, we were talking about the idea that maybe there are little people in the woods. I mean, you personally have never seen them, but, I mean, you would have to be open-minded that if you did see one, you would have to accept the possibility that they are also out there.
Well, I'm certainly open-minded now, trust me. A lot has happened in the last 4 or 5 years that I never thought I'd see or experience, and I have no box now. Matter of fact, I'm kind of just floating out there in space with, you know, whatever comes my way, I'm going to process it. I have no box that I exist in now. And I think when you're pursuing the truth, that's the way you got to do it. You can't say, I'm going to make whatever I encounter fit into my theoretical box. That's not a good scientific approach in pursuit of the truth. That's not the way it's done.
All right, so we got some sound clips here that we're going to play on the show. And the first one here is a whispering adolescent Bigfoot. And I'm going to play it a couple of times, then I'll let you take us through more details on it. So here we go. And I'll play that one more time. So go ahead and explain that one, and then I'll play it one more time so people can hear it again.
Sure. What the adolescent male Sasquatch is whispering is AGA-Y8. So when your listeners hear it one more time, they need to listen for the whispering of Ego Y8. Now, we captured that when my son, who was 4 years old at the time, 4 years ago, woke up in the morning, knew we were recording, needed to go to the bathroom, unzipped the tent, went out to the portable toilet, realized that the 5-gallon water jug was too heavy for him to lift to pour into the toilet, so came back into the tent, whispered to me, "Daddy, I can't, you know, pour the water." So I said, "Okay, son, I'll be out in just a moment." So he went back outside the tent and waited for me. Well, later on, when I was listening to the audio recording, because we record all night long for 10, 12, 14 hours, and I was listening to when he exited the tent on both occasions, the male Sasquatch whispered, "Ego Y8. So listen for Ego Y8.
Here we go. Ego Y8.
Yeah, pretty cool. That was our first recorded vocal ever, and we've captured a lot since that time. But that definitely got me excited, and that definitely moved me out of any kind of descendant of Gigantopithecus camp. These are forest people. They have a spoken language. It's amazing.
All right, next up we've got Singing Daddy Bigfoot Amplified. So I'll play this one, and then we'll let you talk about it. And one more time. That's a weird noise.
That's Daddy being musical, and that was on the same night that we recorded the baby and Mama fussing. The baby fussing with Mama, comforting the baby all night long, which, again, we think we recorded it shortly after its birth about 3 years ago. And I think Dad was happy.
All right, one more time. There you go. 3 years ago, you say.
About 3 years ago. I can guarantee you that was not a squirrel or a deer or a cougar or a bear.
All right, now the next one here is apparently a Bigfoot saying, "Matt, Matt, Matt," while the car...
Can I explain the background? Can I explain the background before you play that?
Sure.
Okay, so Johnny Manson, who is promoting the Sasquatch Summit in Aberdeen, Washington, in a couple weeks from now on the west coast of Washington.
Actually, next weekend.
He came up with me to SOA after I spoke at his conference in November of 2013. So we're up at SOA in December of 2013, almost 2 years ago. And we're up there, and it's about 22 degrees outside. And it's very cold, and so we need to warm ourselves up. There's no light permitted in the camp, including campfire. So the only way we're going to be able to warm ourselves up is by climbing into my Chevy Suburban, turning on the engine, turning on the heater, and warming ourselves up. So we get in the car, we close the doors, the engine's idling, but we have the parabolic microphone dish still recording. And so when we get in the car and close the doors, all of a sudden the parabolic microphone dish catches the adolescent male Squatch whispering my name three times and getting a little more intense each time.
All righty, here we go. That sounds like Matt.
Yep.
Let's do one more.
Okay.
You think it's easier because you've got a one-syllable name?
Well, when I'm up there every night, I'm, you know, standing in the dark either by myself on a solo trip or I have guests with me, and I'm talking with them and I'm tapping my chest and I go, "My name is Matt. Matt. My name is Matt. What's your name? My name is Matt. Can you tell me your name?" And then I'll have my guests say their name. I have them recorded saying my name over 30 times. I have them recorded saying my dog's name twice. I have them recorded saying my fiance's name once, and I have them recorded saying Adam Davies' name once. They say Adam.
All right, this next one here is a mama squatch saying Luke Kana.
Let me give some background before you play that. So we're up there, myself, my fiance, another female guest, and my boy, and my little 7-pound toy fox terrier. And we're sitting in the base camp. It's in the middle of the night. It's pitch dark, no campfire, no lanterns, and they're on the perimeter around us. And my little dog hops down off my lap, goes over and drinks some water, and then chokes on the water. Now, during the whole process, I start off the recording that they're going to listen to by replaying or looping mom saying, Lukana, Lukana, Lukana. And you'll hear it in an adult female voice. And then you'll hear my dog drinking the water. And then you'll hear her say Lukana when she really said it. And then you'll hear him choke. And then I loop Lukana, Lukana, Lukana again, just so the listener can hear mama say it. So with that in mind, go ahead and play the audio.
Hear that Lukana there at the end. I think that dog choking may have just scared everybody half to death.
Yeah, he has some drinking issues.
Next, we have a female juvenile squatch talking okay. In the SOA base camp.
So let me give some background on that before you play it. What we have going on there, again, Johnny Manson and I are up at SOA. It's December of 2013. It's 22 degrees outside in the middle of the night. We're talking 10 degrees below freezing. There's frost everywhere, icicles hanging from the trees. We're not sleeping in the tent. We're not sleeping in the car. We're sleeping out in the open on cots. We wake up with frost on our face. But this recording was captured around 2:30 in the morning on a mountaintop far away from civilization. And you hear a little girl saying, Nipkia. So when you play it, you'll hear sleeping, breathing heavy. Then you'll hear the little girl say Nipkia. Then you'll hear Johnny Manson and I talk about what he heard. And then you'll end it with hearing her again say Nipkia. So go ahead.
Kid kept waking me up. I'd drift off, and then I would hear the kid.
You hear the female juvenile talk? Is that what you're saying?
It sounded like a toddler to me, but maybe it...
No, it could have been the toddler. The toddler's starting to get verbal, but that female juvenile, she's a chatty Cathy.
Maybe it was... Oh, I think I heard her galvanizing. And it was really cute sounding.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could have sworn half the time I wouldn't look. I would just like cover it up.
Right.
You know. But at one point it sounded like she was at my feet and she just said, like, she just was like one syllable and kind of woke me up.
Well, that definitely doesn't sound like one of you.
Yeah, and I would guarantee you that there's no little human girl up there on the ridgeline in the middle of the night, 22 degrees outside. It was not a human. That was a female juvenile Sasquatch.
And finally here, we've got Bigfoot vocal number 8. This is from June 9, 2014.
Okay, so let me give you some background on that. I'm up there with Adam Davies and John Carlson. We've been up and we got up and checked the gifting bowls. We brought the gifting bowls back to camp, and then we climbed back into bed to get some more sleep because we're all tired. So daylight is starting to happen. Birds are starting to sing, and we left some of the cinnamon rolls on the table at the 12 o'clock position on the perimeter. And the parabolic microphone dish was right there on that table. And so while we're sleeping on our cots in the base camp, it sounds like two or three squatches come right up to that table, and you can kind of hear them converse. And then you hear one of them almost sing like, "Ah, de Weilu," and they left with the cinnamon rolls. They came into camp to snag the cinnamon rolls.
Huh.
So it was almost like, score, we got the cinnamon rolls. So enjoy.
Here we go. There you go. Let's play it one more time. Excitement over cinnamon rolls.
Yes, they love the cinnamon rolls. They were excited. They loved them enough to come into camp while we were sleeping to take the rolls. And they rarely ever take anything from the base camp. So they really love those cinnamon rolls. We woke up and we were going to eat those cinnamon rolls and they were gone. It was funny.
All right, now we got to make sure that we talk about this SOA portal. What?
Sure.
Exactly happened?
Well, John and Adam came to visit SOA with me. Adam was doing a West Coast tour. He started off with Derek Randall's Olympic Project. Then he came down to SOA. He was going to spend 4 nights, 5 days with me. The first 2 nights, we had a lot of Sasquatch activity on the perimeter, which was, you know, impressive to the both of them. And on the third day, we went on a little tour. I was being a good host, so during the day, we always come off the mountain, and I show my guests around the area. And I took them to the Oregon House of Mystery, the Oregon Vortex. And then we also went to Crater Lake. And we came back to camp, and we got things ready, put the gifting bowls out. It was dark, and then they were back in the smoking section. I grew up with a mom who smokes. I have asthma. I don't like smoking, don't enjoy it. So if I have any guests that come with me to SOA who smoke, they have to go back to the 6 o'clock position and smoke far away from me. And so they were back there talking, laughing, smoking, talking, laughing, smoking. Well, all of a sudden they're calling me to come around, you know, the suburban, and I'm like, you know, a little frustrated. It's like, you know, get up here. I'm working the 9, 12 to 3 position, and I have squatches on the perimeter. That's what you came here for. You guys get your butts up here. Matt, come here. You come up here. Come here, Matt. So I walk around the end of the suburban, and all of a sudden I see down at the 6 o'clock position a portal. Kind of like on Stargate is opened up, and you can see red sky, dark scraggly vegetation, and eventually
it's like a big round circle.
Yes. Yeah.
About how tall?
Yes. I don't know. It had to have been 8-10 feet off the ground.
And how big was it?
As wide as a logging road.
Wow.
It was big. And you could clearly see red sky and dark scraggly vegetation. You know, there were no trees growing on that logging road, but there were trees there. And it wasn't because there were trees on the logging road. It was because we were looking through a portal into another dimension, another world, and there were certainly dark, scraggly vegetation there. And then these 2 3-foot-tall beings come out, and they're dark, and they have glowing red eyes, and I call them guardians of the portal. And Adam and John, they don't dispute the fact that it happened. Matter of fact, they were recently interviewed on a radio program confirming that it did happen. The only thing that we're in disagreement about is what were those 2 3-foot-tall beings. I think that they were guardians simply doing their job, keeping Adam and John from going through the portal. Matter of fact, that's what I was told via a mind speak experience, which we can get to in a little bit. On the other hand, John and Adam, they think they're demonic beings, and they choose to dichotomize the situation. They want to separate that experience from the Squatches and Soa. Like there's two different things going on up there that are totally unrelated, which is bogus garbage. There's no way that they're not related, especially after the fact that 3 months after that occurred, in September of 2014, I saw a Squatch walk out of that portal. So they definitely are connected. They're not, you can't dichotomize it. However, people do tend to split things or dichotomize things as a coping mechanism to deal with things that they find overwhelming or traumatic. So that's kind of normal to dichotomize it, to separate it, to split it. But I guarantee you, they're not two separate phenomenon. They're all interconnected.
Now, clearly, this would be a report that the BFRO would disregard, correct?
They would keep six it in a heartbeat, yes.
So you've seen this now twice?
Actually, we saw it two nights in a row up there, John, Adam, and myself, and my, at that time, my seven-year-old son. He's 8 years old now. And then I tried to open it up. After that, every month I was up there by myself or with other people because I thought it was proximity that triggered it. And so we would walk close to it and nothing happened. Nothing happened. Month after month, nothing happened. And then a year later, I finally figured it out. I finally went through my memory banks and realized the day that we triggered that portal in June of 2014, I took John and Adam to the Oregon House of Mystery, the Oregon Vortex. So I had a group of people up there with me, and I said, guys, we're going to conduct an experiment. I'm not going to tell you what it is until after we're done, and you have to trust me, you know. And they say, we trust you, so go for it. So I took them to the Oregon House of Mystery, the Oregon Vortex. We came back that night, and we opened the portal. Now, it wasn't to the realm of red sky and dark scraggly vegetation. Instead, this was a dimension of light and energy. And so we all witnessed that in June of 2015, again in July of 2015, September of 2015, and October of 2015. So one of the things that Adam says in his radio interview, it can't be replicated, it can't be duplicated, it's just a story. Well, that's not true. I have replicated it. We have reopened the portal four times since that event occurred last year, and I have figured out how to do it.
So you're telling me that if I went down to Oregon and you took me to the vortex and then we went back to SOA, the portal would open?
Yep. We did it four times in a row. I'm telling you that. And we also went up there without going to the vortex, and I had people do it and they couldn't open it up. Matter of fact, in September, three of us went to the vortex, and the gal did not go to the vortex. And so we sent her down to the portal area by herself while we remained in camp. She's a brave girl, by the way. And she went down there, hung out for 15 minutes, nothing happened. She came back to base camp. She waited in base camp while the three of us who did go to the Oregon vortex went down to the portal, and all of a sudden we opened it up. The two nights before, we couldn't open it up, but that night we opened it up. And then I was thinking, okay, so does going to the Oregon vortex kind of trigger a perception? You're able to see something that you can't see if you don't go to the vortex? Or does it indeed give you some kind of energy key to open up the door? So we invited Shelley to come from the base camp down to the portal area where we were because we had it opened up. And we asked her, can you see, what do you see? And she described everything we were seeing. So even though she did not go to the Oregon vortex, she could see what we were seeing because we have the key. She did not have the key.
So there's little guys that you consider to be guardians. Other people believe they're demons. And you say that you have information which leads you to believe that they are merely guardians.
Yes, on the fourth night, which would be the second night of the portal, while John and Adam, you know, are doing battle with, which these are Adam's own words that he repeated numerous times, doing battle with the guardians of the interdimensional portal while surrounded by Bigfoot. Okay, while they were doing that, I went to bed. Why did I go to bed? Because I was tired, because I was driving people around all day while they were sleeping in the car. And there's no way that I was going to drive all day, stay awake all night, drive all day, stay awake all night. I needed to get some sleep. And also at that time, I had been up there for 8 years, and I woke up alive every morning, so I knew I wasn't in danger. And I thought they were over-dramatizing the situation by the way they were behaving. I encouraged them to go to bed, and they refused to do so in fear that these guardians would come in and injure them, hurt them, take their lives. And so I was sleeping. And the adolescent male and I have occasionally, rarely, had some mind-speak experiences, some exchanges. And he was sharing with me in my dream that they were simply guardians doing their job, keeping my friends from going to through the portal, and that my friends were kind of ticking them off because they were opening the portal and closing the portal, opening the portal and closing the portal, opening the portal and closing the portal, and it was frustrating the guardians. So they were trying to get them to back off away from the portal. But Adam and John interpreted all that as them being aggressive and demonic, and they're short and dark with glowing red eyes, therefore they had to be demonic. And, you know, I don't think they are. I think they were just working their 9-to-5 shift, and I'm sure they went home to their spouses saying, honey, I had the weirdest day. There were these two hairless beings trying to get through our portal, and we had to keep backing them off. You know, I could just hear that and laugh.
Have you considered attempting to go through it?
No. No. Not yet. No.
I mean, they're coming through one way.
Yeah, they are.
So
why not go the other way? Well, you know, can our bodies withstand it? Will we be able to come back? I'm 53. I have an 8-year-old boy. I want to at least get him through high school and college first before I consider going. I have a fiance who I'm going to marry soon, and I don't want to leave her behind. We've talked about it. You know, if that happens, we go through together. I don't leave her behind. So, you know, we'll see someday, maybe. And part of, by the way, part of the frustration that I have is that when Adam and John accidentally triggered that portal, I was pissed. I was frustrated. And the reason why is because I thought I finally figured most of it out. I thought I had a handle on what was going on in SOA. Then all of a sudden there's a freaking portal with two guardians, and I realize how much I don't know. And so because of that discovery, a lot of people are about the portal, the portal, the portal, and SOA, the portal. And it's like, no, you know what? The focus of the research isn't shifting. We're not going to neglect the squatches and the development of trust and the relationship up there to shift it over to a portal. That'd be like showing up to your best friend's house, and instead of paying attention to your friend and developing and fostering that friendship with your friend, you hang out by his front door, and you just talk about how awesome this front door is. Not going to do that.
What if somebody came to you and said, let's go to the vortex and I'll go through?
You know, I have thought about that and have thought about sitting down across the table from the Josephine County Sheriff or the police officer and trying to explain to them that I really didn't hide a body anywhere. I'm not guilty of doing anything, and they really did walk through a portal. And so, again, no. But when we're up there, although the portal is not a primary focus of the research, I will take one night, and one night only, to show my guests that it's there. We will go to the Oregon Vortex. We will come back. We will open it up. And I'll get confirmation by more and more witnesses that, dang, the portal's there, and Dr. J is opening it up like he says he can. And then we shift our focus to the Squatches the rest of the time. Because I figure if they want me, if the Squatches want me to know more about the portal, to go through the portal, when it's time, they'll let me know.
What does your fiancé think of all of this?
She loves it. She said, I was living a pretty boring life until I met you. Now all these sci-fi things that I never thought I were going to be real or I could experience. You know, it's all happening. I've heard Bigfoot. I've seen Bigfoot. I've seen a portal. You know, this is a fun ride. I'm glad we met.
Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the various websites and social media and such here. Team Squatchin' USA, obviously, is the main website, and there's links all over that to media and various products, blog, resources. Tell everybody about the website, the Facebook page, and more.
Okay, well, the website is simply TeamSquatchinUSA.com, and Squatchin is, there's no G in it. It's not Squatchin, it's Squatchin, so TeamSquatchinUSA.com. At that website, upper right-hand corner, you can click on a link that goes to YouTube, but you could also go to YouTube.com and type in TeamSquatchinUSA, and we have over 100 videos that people could enjoy, again, for free. You could also, on the website, upper right-hand corner, click on the SoundCloud link, or just go directly to SoundCloud.com, type in Team Squatchin' USA, and listen to the plethora of audio recordings we have there, once again, for free. There's also a link to click on our Facebook group, which is Team Squatchin' USA, imagine that. And we have about 6,500 members, and we have people from all walks of life in Bigfootdom who kind of contribute what they're finding online. We have some moles and trolls as well, but we do a pretty good job of managing our group. And so if anyone misbehaves and behaves rudely towards somebody else or disrespectfully, then, you know, they get booted from the group, because we keep a focus of a family-oriented group, and we don't allow ugliness in our group. But there's a whole lot of wonderful researchers there sharing a lot of information. And it's a good place for your listeners to come to and learn more.
TeamSquatchinUSA.com. That's TeamSquatchin, no G, TeamSquatchinUSA.com. Everything you need to know is there. All of the links to the Facebook page, the SoundCloud page, and everything else. Dr. Matthew A. Johnson was our guest today, Dr. J. And I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and hopefully we can have you back on again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And of course, we'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here for the final segment of the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Don't forget, the third annual Sasquatch Summit kicks off this Friday, November 20th, at the Quinault Beach Resort and Casino in Ocean Shores, Washington. I will be there on Saturday enjoying all of the festivities. Hope to see some of you listening show up there. Tickets are only $30 for the entire weekend, and you can get more information at SasquatchSummit.com. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening here tonight. We are, of course, here every Sunday night, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. I want to thank Keith Rowland, the man behind the Dark Matter Digital Network, the great Art Bell, and of course, all of you. We'll talk to you again next time, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.
Down in the